You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Fantastic, thank you. Isn't this great? Greenbelt 2026. And the sun's shining. At the moment. Fantastic. Well, thank you for coming to take part in this session in which we're covering something which I feel is really very important and perhaps has a bearing on lots of other things that we think about and talk about at Greenbelt. So let me begin by nailing a few colours to the mast, okay? I think it's fair to say that I am a woke, green, left-leaning liberal. I'm among friends. Or as I prefer to say, I try to give a shit. So this may sound a little bit like my own rewriting of the Nicene Creed, but I despise racism, xenophobia, and religious bigotry. I believe in welcoming strangers wherever they come from. I believe that people should always take priority over power structures and profit. I believe misogyny is a form of insanity. I support gay pride, queer values, same-sex unions, and trans rights. I love diversity. I believe in freedom to be, where freedom to be does not harm or impair others being free. I believe in democracy. I believe in a society based on goodness, compassion, and kindness. And I reckon that driving Palestinians from their homes and historic lands is ethnic cleansing, period. Yes. I believe that Hamas committed monstrous atrocities on October the 7th, not least killing over 1,100 innocent Israelis. But the slaughter of 70,000 Palestinians in Gaza since October the 7th, 2023, is genocide, full stop. I believe we are all earthlings, that we must recover a primal sense of deep belonging and interconnectedness with the earth and all its creatures, if we're going to have a piss of a chance of solving the ecological and climate crisis. Oh, and I believe that all of this is utterly integral to what it means to follow Jesus in today's world. So, hey, if any of this means that I'm woke or lefty or green or whatever the heck, count me in, guys. Do I hear an amen?
Amen.
But, and this is what I'm here to say this morning. I also have a deep aversion to what's often called cancel culture, to calling out, silencing, ostracizing, shaming, or boycotting those with a different point of view, whose ideas I may find disagreeable or deeply offensive. Please note, I did not say that there's no place for canceling, but that I do have a deep aversion to it for reasons I hope to explain. But let me first lay down a couple of precursors to what I want to bring today. First, I'm well aware that for some people, these issues are not theoretical. It's not a theoretical debate. You have been hurt or bullied or intimidated by those who take a different view to the one that I outlined a moment ago. I get that. And I'm glad to know that the wellbeing team are here. And if you find anything in what I say or over the weekend disturbing or troubling, or you need someone to talk to, please do take advantage of that. We have a trans grandson of whom we are very, very proud. I've engaged in hours of wonderful conversation with him. He's happy to be a him. About how the world feels from inside his skin, which I've found very, very helpful. I think I know about these issues. I understood them. I've stood on a certain platform for a long time. But talking with someone who is living through some of these issues can be quite a different and enlightening thing. We also have a daughter who is gay. And I know lots of people say, oh, this is why Dave Tomlinson is a pinko liberal and all that sort of thing. It's because you've got a gay daughter. Saying that and within my earshot is likely to cause quite an eruption. I've been talking about these things for decades now, here at Greenbelt, actually. But I know about the nasty prejudice that she and her wife have experienced over the years. So I understand completely why, for some people, the safest thing to do is to avoid certain situations, to avoid engaging with certain people or ideas. My second precursor is this. Some things do need calling out. Like when a person is actively hurting or threatening to hurt others through cruel, abusive, or exploitative behavior. And we should indeed call that out or report it wherever appropriate. I mean, I'm baffled, for example, that none of those who knew about the awful abuse that John Smythe was inflicting on young boys in the course of his fake youth ministry did not call it out. And some of them really should hang their heads in shame because of that. But it's not just him. There are others, and it goes on, abusers and other forms of abuse in the church as well as in wider society that needs calling out and needs stopping. I'm not making any bones about that. All of that said, my real concern today is that our world is increasingly divided, hostile, and polarized, and people aren't really listening to each other anymore. Echo chambers and mutual shouting have replaced proper public debate. To me, cancel culture is really a form of fighting fire with fire, which, guess what, creates bigger fires. Adding to rather than diminishing the brokenness and polarization that we seem to be sliding into deeper and deeper by the day, and troubles me not just for myself. My time in this world is coming toward a close at some point. Well, that's true of all of us. But I fear for, you know, our children, our grandchildren, and for others in the future as to what kind of world we seem to be slipping into. And the fires are blazing right now, consuming many people in what the broadcaster Nikki Campbell has called a cacophony of polarization and mutual demonization. Now, his radio and TV talk shows have always fostered feisty, combative exchanges that I have to say I've never really much enjoyed. But now, Nikki Campbell says, the differences have become ossified, weaponized, and tribalized. People increasingly dislike each other, he says. And anyone who engages with social media knows how true this is. The levels of toxicity and hatred have never been so loud, so blatant, and unrestrained. And you know what? Christians on all sides of the arguments are sometimes among the worst, from my observation. Hearing noxious hatred from bigoted racists and homophobes is no surprise at all. But I cringe at the way I hear some, you know, even progressively minded Christians responding with arguments that I agree with, but with a similar bullying tone to arguments that I utterly disagree with. If fundamentalism is seen as a framework of absolutism, I think that it comes in many different forms. And there are liberal and progressive fundamentalists. There's liberal and fundamentalist progressives. What did I say? Progressive fundamentalism, just as there, you know, is conservative biblical fundamentalism and all that. So I'm asking, are there better ways? Are there better ways to disagree? Better ways to combat the things that concern us so deeply? Better ways to try to change opinions in the world? To spread the goodness that we all long to see a whole lot more of. Jesus tells us to love our enemies. And Paul speaks in Corinthians about God giving us a ministry of reconciliation. So what do these things mean? What do these things mean in the context of today's culture wars that ignite such dangerous fires of hatred, antagonism, and enmity? Certainly, I do not accept that loving our enemies or pursuing reconciliation means backing down or compromising on what we passionately believe and value and are committed to. No, not at all. It cannot possibly mean that. Loving our enemies is not the same as being weak-kneed or wishy-washy or backing down. That's not loving enemies. That's cowardice and capitulation. So what does loving our enemies mean in the context of culture wars? I think it starts by acknowledging our common humanity, which may mean looking into our own hearts and recognizing reverse versions of the very things that we disdain in others. Dehumanizing those we disagree with is the same thing, whichever way we approach it or look at it. So just pause for a moment. I'd like to invite you to just pause, close your eyes, and take a deep breath. And I'd like you to identify a person who you find it very difficult to like. It may be a politician or some other public figure, maybe someone that you know personally, a member of your own family. Take another breath and just focus for a moment on what you feel in your body when you think about them. What emotions do they evoke? I mean, I could tell you some of the people that enter my mind at that point, possibly, I think almost certainly, some of the same people that come into your mind. How much do we know about them, apart from the bits that we see and are aware of? Can you imagine that there may be things about them that are not represented by the views or behavior that we dislike so much? Their love of family members, their love of pets. Everybody loves a puppy. Is it possible that they may have views on things? I don't know, music, beer, hopes for the future that we share in common. Could that be possible? I mean, if you find that hard to imagine, join the club. So what does loving our enemies mean in the context of culture wars? Well, not necessarily agreeing with them, that's for sure. Not having warm, cuddly feelings toward them, that's definitely for sure. But love as Jesus understood it isn't about those things. In essence, I think loving our enemies means opening up to radical empathy, treating our political or ideological opponents with active kindness, respect and goodwill that we may not feel is coming from them, instead of responding with hatred or revenge. I think that's at the core of what Jesus is talking about. Remember, fighting fire with fire makes bigger fires, which I think is why Jesus rejected an eye for an eye as a personal guide for behavior. He told us to pray for and help those who oppose or hurt us. It's about extinguishing fires wherever possible by placing dignity over hate. God showing goodness to people doesn't mean that he necessarily likes everything about them or what they're doing. The culture wars divide society into hostile camps over politics, morality, and identity. The Jesus way does not mean diminishing the strength of our convictions and values. It's how we go about contending for those values and convictions. And what different outcomes could just be possible if we did that. So I want to play you a soundtrack to a little video in a moment. It's a conversation between two people. Maybe you've come across it. Two people who meet at an anti-Trump protest in the build-up to the election. One of the people speaking, you'll know who, is a Trump supporter with the famous red MAGA cap, who gets caught up in this hostile anti-Trump crowd. The other person is a young Muslim woman in a hijab who actually comes to his rescue. Take a listen to this.
I noticed you with the hat, mm-hmm. and I noticed that you were surrounded by some people, and I noticed that they were being kind of threatening.
I heard a click of a lighter right behind my ear, and there were about three people trying to light my shirt on fire with lighters.
And then somebody snatched your hat off your head, and that's the point where I something kind of snapped inside me because I wear a Muslim hijab, and I've been in situations where people have tried to snatch it off my head.
Wow.
And I rushed towards you and I just started screaming, leave him alone, give me that back.
I don't think we could be any further apart as people. And yet it was just kind of like this common, that's not okay moment. You are genuinely the only Muslim person I know. I just, it's not that I've actively avoided. It's just,
yeah.
I've just never been in the position where I can interact mm-hmm. for an extended period of time. So I guess my views on the Muslim community have been influenced by a lot of the news articles and things of that nature.
I feel like a lot of times in the media, you don't see the normal Muslim, the one that listens to classic rock like I do. you don't meet that Muslim.
Can you tell me about where you grew up? What was that part of your life like?
So I was born in Baghdad in Iraq. I moved to the U.S. when I was 10 years old.
Okay.
Being a Muslim girl, I stood out in almost every single way that you can in middle school, the worst time to stand out. What about you? How was it like when you grew up?
I was homeschooled. Mm-hmm. So it was a vastly different experience socially. I didn't have, I guess, as many friends as most people would. I only went to public school 1 year of my life, and I got in 3 fights, and I lost all of them. I actually lost a lot of friends because of this election, because of my political stance. So I hope that I can be the reason that someone decides to talk to someone as opposed to just cutting them out of their life or blocking them on Twitter, yeah. You know?
I'd like for this to encourage other people to engage in more conversations yeah. with people that you don't agree with.
That's what it's all about. I'm so glad I wasn't the only one who felt like that.
Isn't that wonderful? It's a conversation between two human beings, right? Coming from very different places with different... And there's nothing in that conversation that says that they suddenly, you know, he suddenly sort of stopped being a Trump supporter or she was converted to Trump. But it was human beings talking and engaging. Loving our enemies means refusing, and sometimes that takes real effort, refusing to dehumanize the other person. And I do it all the time. I confess that, you know, watching people on television, listening to voices speaking and so on. And what I was trying to lead us to in a moment ago, my body feels it, you know, my emotions feel it. I find myself despising people. And I have to go through this process again and again and again because it's work, right? It's doing the work. Refusing to dehumanize is work. And we stop viewing the other person as an evil enemy and begin to look for their humanity. We stop the name-calling and the mockery so common today on social media or in political arguments and try to listen to the fears that people have behind what is coming across, the values, the things that are important to them, which seem so alien to me. And I begin to listen to these before reacting and jumping down people's throats and calling them idiots, because they obviously are. You know, it's about separating the person from the rhetoric. I think that falls for me within the context of what I would call redemptive. You know, it's a redemptive thing to do. When we can separate what a person is saying and a position that they're holding from who they are as a human being. Do you remember the stabbing of those three beautiful little girls at a dance class in Southport in 2024? As you may remember, it sparked anti-Muslim and racist demonstrations across the country, including in my hometown, Liverpool, where the oldest recorded mosque in the UK... I didn't know that until I was looking it up, but it was besieged by this angry right-wing mob who were shouting and threatening and waving their fists. In the very midst of all of that hostility, Imam Adam Kelwick made the brave decision to leave the security of the mosque and to go against police advice So instead of staying locked up, he and a few other members of the mosque crossed the barrier, the police barricade, to engage directly with the protesters. They took out food, which at first was, I think, just completely through the protesters. They didn't know. They didn't know whether they were allowed to take it, even if they wanted it or not. You know, it was a subversive act, a subversively loving act. And so they began to talk, and the man one man responded to the humanity that he was being offered, and took up the invitation to enter the mosque and talk further. And the imam said, "What is it that you fear? You know, what is it that you feel so strongly about? What are you afraid of?" And suddenly a conversation took place that I would say is a redemptive kind of conversation. Digging beneath the surface and getting to the heart. And later on, when he was asked about it, the imam simply said, "I was just being nice to people who were being nasty." Well, I think that falls well into the category of what it means to love our enemies. Loving our enemy does not mean agreeing with people. It does not mean standing by in the face of injustice that we really need to do something about. It does not stop us opposing harmful laws or actions. It means behaving like human beings, as Jesus, the epitome of true humanity, taught us. You know, Jesus actually barely, I mean, I think you've got to squeeze it out to find the word Son of God in the mouth of Jesus. It's kind of in John's Gospel implied. But what we find over 80 times through the Gospels is Jesus describing himself by his favorite self identity, which was Son of Man, which just simply means the human being. And to me, that is crucial to what the Christian message is about. I don't think Jesus saves us by winging us off to heaven when we die, whatever you think about that. He saves us by showing us what humanity is supposed to look like and calling us to follow and imitate that. I believe that the only redemptive way forward in this fraught world of culture wars is to engage. That's the word that I really want to put out there today. It's about engagement, to engage with those with whom we disagree, engage as much as possible with their humanity, engage with their fears and concerns, but also engage with their arguments, hopefully by having better arguments. And that's, I think, something there's a great dearth of, really. There's a lot of shouting and hollering goes on, but what we need is cool-headed, calculated, better arguments to many of the arguments that are out there. A few years ago, Pat and I travelled around the West Bank of Palestine, meeting lots and lots of very lovely people. And we visited the Tents of Nations, which is a 100-acre farm owned by Daoud Nasser and his family just outside Bethlehem. And this now is a farm that is besieged all around on all the mountains roundabout by Israeli settlements. And you may know he was supposed to be at Greenbelt a couple of years ago, but couldn't make it because of all the troubles in Gaza. So he talked to us in the communion service through a video link. And if you heard that, you'll know what a wonderful man he is. We witnessed the unbearable struggle that folk at the Tent of Nations and other places around the West Bank experience every single day just to get by, just to survive. In the case of the farm, with these enormous great boulders that we had to clamber over that cover the road, blocking the exit in or out. Constant threats and bullying, the olive groves being bulldozed by settlers. Daoud is still patiently pursuing justice from the Israeli courts. But most powerful of all is the statement at the gate of that farm, where it says Tent of Nations. And then in English, Arabic, Hebrew and German, it says, "We refuse to be enemies." I mean, bloody hell. That is just such an amazing statement of holy rebellion. Says, "You want to play that game, but I'm not going to play it. I refuse to be your enemy." One of my most graceful moments here at Greenbelt was some years back. listening to Bruce Kent. Anybody hear Bruce Kent when he was here? Bruce Kent was sadly not with us now, but he was a Catholic priest and the chair of CND. He was an intimidatingly articulate man, but also deeply gracious. And in the midst of his hugely impressive talk to a massively crowded tent about peace and nuclear disarmament, a young American stood up and started calling out to him, saying, "You people don't understand. You don't understand what we Americans are about, that we are protecting the world from communism, which is why we need nuclear arms. We need the biggest bombs. We need the most powerful weapons." And as he was speaking, many in the crowd, fairly understandably perhaps, were booing and hissing and calling on him to sit down. And Bruce Kent quietened the whole crowd. He made them all be quiet and he said, "Let him speak, let him speak." So the young man had his say. And then Bruce responded. He said, "I'm pleased that you've said what you've said. You obviously feel this very strongly. You've argued passionately and you have a right to express those views and many people agree with you. However, I think your self-image as Americans is appallingly mistaken." And he then went on to almost with surgical accuracy to dismantle the man's arguments piece by piece with enormous uncompromising eloquence. But he did it with this wonderful grace and humanity. I'd never met Bruce up in that time. Subsequently, I did interview him for a magazine. But I stood on the edge of that crowd that day, weeping, feeling that I was in the presence of Jesus. What I love about this festival, Greenbelt, is the courage of the board over many years now to take risks. I would argue, I wouldn't argue, you'll be relieved to know. You don't know what I'm saying, yeah? But I would not argue that we should invite Tommy Robinson to hold forth on the main stage. But I do believe deeply that Greenbelt should be and should constantly and always be a space where we can have difficult, challenging, and respectful conversations with people of different convictions. I think it's a big part of what we stand for, and long may it continue. Do I hear an amen? Amen. None of the people that we have speaking at Greenbelt or taking part in discussions or debates will be entirely pure or free from ideas that some others of us will disagree with, or I wouldn't be allowed here in the first place. But I love what Rowan Williams says in an interview in the latest New Humanist magazine. And note what I just said there. I subscribe to the New Humanist magazine. I think it's actually pretty wonderful. I often say I am a Christian humanist. And but he gave a wonderful interview there talking about Christian nationalism. It's, you know, buy that edition alone to read it. But he says this at the end of the interview. He says, "The problem with our discourse is often the assumption that if you have the wrong view on one thing, then you cannot be talked to about anything else." I think that's so, so very important. So people just become labelled that that is who they are. They belong to this camp. They're one of them and so on. And then nothing else can be listened to about what they say. Everything is polluted by the fact that they take that position. As I draw to a close, I want to read a person and poem by the Israeli writer and poet Yehuda Amichai, who himself took part. He was a soldier in the IDF in 1948. But it was through the experience of being an Israeli soldier that he came to oppose war and believe that war was a bad thing, and he became a peacemaker. And this poem is called "The Place Where We Are Right." From the place where we are right, flowers will never grow in the spring. From the place where we are right, flowers will never grow in the spring. The place where we are right is hard and trampled like a yard. But doubts and loves, dig up the world like a mole, a plough. and a whisper will be heard in the place where the ruined house once stood. I love that poem. It's a poem that addresses what Nikki Campbell identifies as a pandemic of certainty. Amichai calls us to question our certainties, to ask about the flaws in our thinking. It's a poem of humility and vulnerability, which in itself makes way for the possibility of different outcomes. Through doubt, we abandon absolutism. So lots of us, especially in the more progressive camp, talk about doubt in a very favorable way. And we oppose strongly those people who see doubt as being, you know, a sign of backsliding or the work of the enemy or something. But it cuts both ways, you know. And I once said to someone who I worked with very closely, I said, you know, and this was in a time of severe fracture and conflict between us. And I said, I don't think you ever lie awake at night worrying whether you might be wrong. I do, actually. I still do. I still entertain doubts about the things that I feel very passionately about. Because I think that once we reach a point of absolutism, where nothing about our position is open to question, where we can't listen to what those with different points of view have got to say about our position, then I think we've reached a very bad place. I think that it is through doubt that we abandon that absolutism. Through love, we can identify a shared humanity. Doubts and loves dig up the ground. And the ruined house represents the collapse of rigid structures and broken relationships. Only after they come down can we hear each other's quiet, honest whispers. So I recognize that there are lines across which cancelling certain voices may be necessary. I've said that, especially when people's safety is at risk. But I'm also convinced that cancel culture as a policy is counterproductive to the pursuit of social and personal justice and the transformation of our world. There has to be a different way than just shouting at each other or refusing to listen to those who disagree with us. The way that Jesus showed us, love your enemies, respect the person, but contend for what is right, is the way forward. Or in more colloquial terms, it's about playing the ball and not the person, the player. So here's a prayer that I want to finish with, inspired by Amichai's poem. God of friends and enemies, whose love conspires to blur the line between the two, enlarge our souls, that we may gaze into the eyes of another to find ourselves looking back, even when minds and hearts are worlds apart. Teach us to stand resilient, owning our truth with fortitude, while attending also to doubts and loves longing to be heard. Help us to see that despite the consolation certainty yields, truth always comes to us as a crumb and never an entire loaf. Amen. Thank you. There is the possibility of some questions, but I think we don't have a radio mic. So it's a case of we've got one on a longish cable. So it won't reach all of you, but if we could just take a couple of questions if you have any.
Hi, Dave. We've been going to Greenbelt for a while, this place. I wonder about who we now invite. We used to think it was really important and radical to listen to wonderful gay brothers and sisters and people who are Palestinians. I was just thinking about next time we meet at Greenbelt, we're not doing next year, inviting maybe the chief rabbi and Danny Kruger. I think we need to start listening, if we're going to carry on the spirit of Greenbelt, to people who many of us would find difficult, but who have a humanity and something that will show that the spirit of Greenbelt is continuing, rather than we're retreating into a progressive place.
Yeah, no. That's a very good question. It's not my decision to make that, but I am part of a board that can discuss these things. And, you know, my speaking personally, my inclination would definitely be to move in that direction. That I think that we have to be able to have more hard conversations. And I think that, you know, that little clip I played earlier on between the Trump supporter and the Muslim woman is such a hopeful little sort of insight, isn't it? And I think that obviously to have those conversations, you need to be sort of prepared each to be in a place of mutual respect in that conversation, you know, so that that doesn't just become shouting at each other. But I think that unless we can give ourselves the time and the patience to listen to some of the arguments that come from a very different place to ours, I don't see how we're going to move forward at all. We'll just end up in this cacophony of different opinions. So I would incline toward that. Though, as I say, it's not for me to decide that. And I think enormous wisdom has to be brought into play to entertain those conversations. But, you know, I've felt for a long time that, to broaden that out a little bit, I've felt for a long time that the church ought to be the host of good debate. And I think too often all we get, you know, within churches is just our own little echo chamber. And I think that we ought to have that. There was a guy, a church in central London, St. Mary Le Bow on Cheapside, where the vicar used to be a wonderful man whose name slips my mind right now. Someone may remember. No, Victor Stock. That was my wife who remembered that. She saved me many times. Victor Stock, who was a remarkable man, and he said he had a church that had no Sundays and no festivals because it was in the centre of London, and so he realized that this church had two pulpits in it, which is kind of interesting. And apparently some 19th century clergy person felt that sermons ought not just to be monologues. Now, I don't know whether it actually worked in practice, but I love the idea. And so Victor would have these lunchtime conversations where he'd be in one and there would be different people from all kinds of walks of life, definitely not all religious, like I was in one, in the other pulpit, and these conversations. And I think that's just a nice little symbolic picture of what I think we need more of in the church community. And that obviously includes Greenbelt. So I think it's a good conversation that you've raised there. Anybody else?
Thank you so much for what you said. I'm aware you might not be able to speak to this directly as a trustee, but I'm aware of the comms that came out when Helen Lewis, who people don't know is a feminist who'd expressed gender critical views, but was invited to Greenbelt to talk about her recent book on genius. And from what I read, it sounds like Greenbelt really agonized over what to do, but she's not here. And it felt a bit like cancelling, and there was a sort of an apology for the people they've hurt by inviting her. And I suppose for me, isn't this the kind of person we need to be able to share a field with, that we might disagree with her? And it could cause pain to people, and I'd really want to support people, but could we have created a safe enough space to have someone like Helen Lewis talking about her recent book and just have her part of here, even if it was difficult?
Thank you. Okay, so what have I opened myself up to here? I'm an individual, okay? I'm speaking as an individual. I've not been briefed, as they say, on this subject. But Personally, I was disappointed that Helen didn't end up here. I'm quite an admirer of Helen Lewis. I don't agree with all her views, but in the spirit of what Rowan Williams said earlier on, I don't think that that means that there's nothing else good to be said here or good conversations to be had. So my understanding, and I may be well off mark here, but my understanding is that she chose not to come in the end. So I don't think that she was cancelled, but it was controversial, as you've said. And I regret that personally. I think that, we must not end up in an echo chamber of just shouting around and listening to our own views. So I don't know if that satisfies you.
Back. So I wondered if anybody in this area will have a question, so we get out into the crowd, not just in the venue. Anybody?
Could you just say the name of the poem that you quoted from? Because I didn't, or the author, I didn't right. note it. Thank
it's
you.
Called as Yehuda. What is this? A class? Yehuda is Y-E-H-U-D-A, right? Yehuda Amachai. A-M-A-C-H-A-I. I think that. But the poem's called The Place Where We Are Right. So if you look up that, you'll find it. And he's got lots of other ones, by the way. He's got a great poem I'd love to have read called Wild Peace. Check that one out.
Hi, Dave. Thank you so much for everything you said. A tension that I really struggle with, and I wonder if you do as well, is I often feel quite strongly that I want to be as charitable as I can to my ideological enemies, and I want to love my enemy, and I do have anxieties sometimes about the tone sometimes that comes from the progressive side, but I often feel very reluctant to articulate that because I'm also painfully conscious that as a straight, white, cisgendered man, I'm not at the sharp end of those people's rhetoric. So there's a part of me that always says, well, it's easy for me to say we should love these people and be kind to these people. I'm not the people they're hurting the most.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And that's why I tried to express something of that in one of the precursors I made. And why I made the point that I'm talking about things which involve members of my family who are very dear and precious to me. And I know the impact that I've seen that these things can have on them. So, yeah, of course, all the time. I mean, I'm even better than you. I'm an old white straight guy. So you might say, what the hell right have you got to talk about these things? Well, I try to speak out of humility and say this, you know, there are things which I understand the personal implications. I've listened to that, and I get it as best as I can as a white old guy, you know. But I do think there are bigger issues that also need to be confronted here, and that's why, you know, I've kind of dared to stand up here and make that point. So I think it is possible to hold the two things together, you know, to on the one hand, it, with deep humility, say, I understand the impact that these things have on people who, in my case, are friends and family members and so on. I understand that. But on the other hand, I understand. I also believe that there are issues that need to be raised and addressed. And that's why I've done it. And I think, just by virtue of, I put up a post on Facebook saying about this session. And I had quite a well-known person in the Christian world contacted me last night, I think it was, sent me a message and said, I'm so pleased to see that you're addressing this, because he said that I have had enormous abuse from progressive Christians because I speak defensively toward the people of Israel. And so I'd like to pursue that conversation with him. I think this is the thing, you know, that if we reduce people's arguments and positions down to our little caricatures, then there is no way forward here. We're just swapping caricatures, you know? But if we can just bother to listen to what it is people are trying to say, why they're saying it and where they're coming, we may still be miles and miles apart, but at least we've acknowledged each other as fellow human beings and accepted the fact that there are people who hold entirely different positions to me, some of whom, not all, but some of whom hold those positions with integrity that I can honour and respect.
Thank you. I'm just wondering if you could give us perhaps some tips on how we can take this back to our smaller parish environments, and particularly if we don't live in a hugely multicultural area where it's necessarily obvious where we can reach across the divides, or even reach out to people who politically perhaps seem different to us. Any ideas on how we might do that at a more local level?
Yes, thank you. I mean, I think that the principle of what I'm saying applies on many different levels. So, the obvious high profile, high octane issues are ones that we've mentioned already. But actually, these same kind of interrelations and breakdown relations take place at all kinds of levels, really, just as an interpersonal level. And I think that often, even as Christians, we're not very good at dealing with difference. And it seems to me that that should be something that's at the core of what it is to be followers of Jesus. And so I think that certainly people in all kinds of areas of all different situations in this country have access to social media. And I think it would be a great thing if those of us who engage in social media can make a concerted effort to put out good news and good noises and engage in more positive interactions with people. Because, I certainly see it every day. I see this sort of haranguing and shouting stuff going on. And sometimes I think the best thing is just let them get on with it, But a lot of times when I just want to try to dip my toe in that water. And so I think that, it's finding where the rubber hits the road with these issues in our own situations. And it, as I say, it may be about just interpersonal relationships. But I think that, as a church leader over the years, decades now, I've worked in various kinds of church leadership. And I've seen so much fracture and schism and falling all over the place from people who, do you know what? They're not a million miles apart, but they just kind of hold certain things with such ferocity that they can't listen to and respect the fact that other people have a different point of view.
Thanks, Dave. Can't actually see you, but I know you're in there because it's kind of dark.
Believe it, brother, I'm here.
Thank you. So just to kind of bring it back to, sorry about the specifics, but the Israel-Palestine situation. So like lots of us here, I'm sure I've been there. I would consider myself pro-Palestinian. But I also, a couple of years ago, I thought, I'm just going to stop coming to Greenbelt because all I ever hear is pro-Palestinian. But as I walked into this venue, I did hear you say what's going on in the West Bank is genocide, end of. And that immediately shuts down a whole area of conversation. So I'm working quite extensively with people who say, the qualification for entry to this conversation is that you accept it's genocide. Or other people say the qualification for entry is that the occupation is illegal. And there's a variety, or some people, it's simply the acceptance that there is a group of people who would call themselves Palestinian. But coming back to the genocide conversation, could we conceive of a situation of having a conversation where we said, I insisted it is genocide, I insisted it is not, and to be able to have that genuine open conversation in this space would be an extraordinary thing to be able to do.
I'm more than agree with you about that. I mean, I was just trying at the beginning to sort of say, look, this is who I am, this is where I'm at, and so that's my position. I'm not saying that's absolutely right in all respects that I stated it. That's just where I'm at. But the conversation I'm absolutely open to have. And that's why I personally, going back to what someone said earlier, I would personally back getting the chief rabbi here and having that, to have a good conversation about these things. I think that unless we can respect the fact that there are nuances, and this is probably one of the things that happens, and maybe I have in my own little way contributed to this, I'll confess. But, you know, I think that there is a complete loss of nuance in an awful lot of discourse today, so that everything is just flattened out into one perspective. So I don't think we want conversations where everyone is treading on eggshells and being nicey-nicey about everything. I think we may have really strong views, and some of us do think that if I mean, do you know what? I mean, I think we can screw ourselves up stupid over words like genocide. In the end, it is what it is, which is awful. But I think that, you know, we can debate these things. We can have those conversations if we are prepared to respect the fact that someone doesn't see it exactly the same way we do. So I would definitely favour more of those kind of conversations, definitely.
Thank you. I think this might echo some of the points that have been raised. My difficulty always is that if someone or some group is sure, fundamentalist, correct, historically driven, then it's very difficult to be able to stand there as one human being to another and sort of share any slight difference in where we're coming from. And then I, if I'm on the other side of that, will get labelled with the whatever the opposite is for them. And I don't know if you've got any tricks about it, but it's how do you find the human being underneath? How do you manage to shift without it just becoming polarised? You know what I mean?
I don't think it's always possible, you know. I don't think it's always possible. And I think that for a good conversation to take place, both people have to be prepared to stand on that ground of wanting to have a good conversation. And, I mean, I've been here at Greenbelt in years gone by and had people shouting me down for things that now nobody has any arguments about, you know. But I've in my travels, I've had people who just will not listen at all. I stood up in Central Hall one time speaking to 2,500 people, and there was a man toward the back who didn't need any PA system, apparently. He had some superhuman, supernatural, booming voice who wouldn't stop shouting at me constantly and refused to stop until I stopped quoting a particular piece that I was giving, you know. And what can you do, you know? When he was actually helped out of the auditorium, later on, miraculously, he appeared on the platform with me at the end and was still going on and on and on and on, you know. So there are people we can't have conversations with. It's just impossible. But I think even in that, we can respond with respect and dignity and not get dragged into, you know, just mud-slinging at each other. So sometimes I think loving our enemies may mean just keeping shtum, you know, because that is the only thing and the best thing that can be done. But I think in many instances, I mean, what was so beautiful about that little clip that I played earlier on was when it suddenly went into personal sort of issues, right? You know, when he said, what about you? Where do you come from? Where did you grow up? You know, and what was it like for you at school? And suddenly you had these kind, so you suddenly went down layers from all of this noise up here. And I think there are times when we can do that. There are people you can't do it with because they're just not going to let you. But I think there's a sort of trajectory, I think, that we should commit ourselves to pursuing and carry on with that until we find that the road's blocked and we can't go any further with it.
I'm afraid this is going to have to be our last question.
Sure.
I really want to endorse your comment about separating the person and the human.
Sorry? Green shirt. Well, let them both ask the question. Sorry, Green Shirt.
Just to endorse your comment about separating the human from the views, I have an old university friend who's an Israeli settler. He's a hardcore Israeli settler, but his wife and two daughters were shot by Hamas gunmen several years ago. It was in the UK press because they were UK citizens. I sent him a letter of support and condolence. It wasn't anything about his views. My views and his would be very different. But my final comment and the question coming out of this is, when you've spoken, the phrase that enters my head is, you have to be in the debate to change the conversation. So I'd be interested in your further reflections on where we go and the places we should take ourselves out of our own places.
Very good, yes. It's a very good point. Let's have Green Shirt.
I feel a bit embarrassed now. It's not so much a question, more a comment. I can't remember whether it was Desmond Tutu or Nelson Mandela who said that the mind is like a parachute. It only works if it's open.
Well, that's really good, I think. And it kind of connects together because I think that, you know, I often find myself drawn back to that little sort of picture in the Gospels of where Jesus lifted up a child and said, unless you become like this child, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. And I've asked myself again and again, what is it about that child, you know? And I think my prevailing view is that it's about openness, that there's something about a child where there's this kind of receptiveness and openness to possibility, to wonder. And I think that what happens is that's where we begin. And then reality and experience and life causes us to contract and pull in so that, you know, we just are boxed in. And I think that if there's one thing more than anything else out of everything that I've said to take away, really it is, can we be committed to a process of becoming more and more open in the world, open to other people without first of all boxing them in or placing them in this category or that, but just open in this moment, in this situation, to this person. And I think that that would lead us down a very different track to coming with all this kind of, all these precursors and information that we have that has already told us everything about this person before we've even encountered them. So that would be, you know, I'm afraid I can't go anymore because I think we've run out of time, but I appreciate you coming. I appreciate you all staying through the questions and everything as well. It doesn't always happen. And I feel that, you know, I woke up this morning feeling some trepidation because I thought I'm walking through quite a difficult sort of path here. There are eggshells all around. But what most of all, I hope that you will hear out of this is my heart, which is a heart that is on the one hand totally committed to certain things that I believe in with all my heart and soul and will stand for as long as I have breath. And on the other hand, one of saying, you know, what kind of world do I want to live in? What kind of world do I want to contribute to? And what kind of world do I want to leave to those who come after me? And that's the tension, I think, but you know, I hope that you've got something. You've made some sense out of all of this.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.